an endless summer, stored with pleasure in my memory.
Sunday evening at 5, here on KPFK 90.7.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today, we turn to a forgotten but suddenly very relevant chapter in American socialist history, the sewer socialists of Milwaukee. For decades in the early 20th century, Milwaukee elected socialist mayors and city councilors who built a reputation for clean government, public ownership, and delivering real material gains for working people, municipal power, public parks, housing, and infrastructure that actually worked. Their legacy has often been disparaged or misunderstood, dismissed as technocratic or overly cautious. But a new article by historian Eric Blanc argues that the Milwaukee socialists offer crucial lessons for today's left, especially right now in New York City, where Zoran Mamdani's breakthrough victory has opened the door to a democratic socialist governing in one of the most powerful cities in the world. Eric Blanc joins me to unpack the history behind the sewer socialists, what they accomplished, what ultimately constrained them, and what lessons their experience holds for contemporary socialist elected officials, from building durable working class institutions to governing competently and confronting the structural limits of municipal power. Stay tuned as we dig into a history that speaks directly to the political moment we're entering today when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we're looking at a piece of American socialist history that's now relevant and urgent, the rise and limits of the so-called sewer socialists of Milwaukee. For decades in the early 20th century, Milwaukee elected socialist mayors and city councils who ran clean, efficient governments, built public power and parks, expanded housing, and delivered concrete improvements to working class life. It was pragmatic, working class, municipal radicalism, or municipal socialism, rooted in unions, multilingual organizing, and a politics that started with people's bills and rent rather than abstract slogans. This wasn't a revolution, and it wasn't meant to be. Milwaukee's socialists governed within capitalism and ran up against its limits, employer backlash, national political shifts, and the hard reality that municipal power can only go so far without broader working class strength. So why does this matter right now? Well, because New York City is entering a new political moment. Zoran Mamdani's breakthrough victory, powered by decades of organizing in immigrant and working class neighborhoods, has reopened the question of whether socialists can not only win but govern in America's largest and most unequal city. Or cities. Eric Blanc, whose new article called Socialists in City Hall, A New Look at Sewer Socialism in Wisconsin, found right now on his Substack, Labor Politics, but soon to be published in Catalyst, revisits the Milwaukee experience, arguing that this history offers essential lessons for today's left: how to build durable political organization, how to use office to win material gains, and how to govern competently while expanding working class power, and how not to mistake municipal office for municipal socialism, or as they said in the day, make the sewers more important than the socialism. We're going to explore what sewer socialists actually achieved, what constrained them, and what all this means for Mamdani and for the prospects of left governance in New York and beyond. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I just want to properly introduce you. Eric Blanc is assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers University. His books include We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. That's a new book. And Red State Revolt, The Teacher's strike wave and working class politics, both of them covered right here. And his writings have appeared in all the good places, Politics and Society, New Labor Forum, The Nation, The Guardian, Jacobin. And Eric is a longtime labor activist and organizer, trainer. He directs the Worker to Worker Collaborative, a center to help unions and rank and file groups scale up their efforts by expanding their members' involvement and leadership. And he even writes about Finland and revolutionary Russia. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Yeah, I'm happy to not talk about Finland today, though.
Yeah, that lesson is different than what we're up against today. And that's, I think we talked about it here, but we certainly can do that another time because it's something that's of enduring importance. So let's just go back to New York, though. And first, I guess, to Milwaukee, because you take on the history of the Milwaukee sewer socialists who've long been the subject of a classic left critique. What drew you to revisit this now and in connection with today's political victory?
Okay. The impetus for writing the article came after Zoran won very unexpectedly the primary by such a decisive margin. And it became all of a sudden clear that there was an actual chance that Zoran Mamdani would be our mayor in New York City. I live in New York City, very active in supporting Zoran and active in Democratic Socialists of America. And I, like many other activists today, had a vague sense that there was this thing called sewer socialism. You know, there was some precedent for socialists running big cities, but frankly, I didn't know anything about it. And so partly just because I wanted to understand the history better, and partly because I was looking for lessons for the new hopeful socialist administration, which now we have, I went and spent months doing a deep dive in both like primary sources and secondary sources to really try to understand the sewer socialists. And the impetus for writing it, in addition to these lessons, is that it became clear to me that a lot of the literature on the sewer socialists and a lot of the things we think about them are actually a little misleading. And there's a more interesting and more dynamic story that hasn't really been told yet.
So, and I do want to get into that because, you know, most of us who are on the far left thought of the term as a derisive one. Before we get into that critique, I want you to explain for our listeners what sewer socialism actually was and why the label has this complicated legacy. And I have a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, it's worth saying that the sewer socialists really never referred to themselves as sewer socialists. This is something that we've come to talk about later on. They were socialists. This is the Social Democratic Party, Socialist Party of Milwaukee, which from 1910 onwards ran Milwaukee for almost 50 years. And not just Milwaukee, but led the entire labor movement of Wisconsin and had a major presence in state politics in Wisconsin. So you're talking about not only a party that was able to govern a city, have a big role in state politics, led a labor movement, and was, by any criteria, the strongest socialist organization that the United States has ever seen. Nothing has ever come as close to the depth and power that the Milwaukee socialists had in the working class in Milwaukee, but really across the state.
Wow. And so we will be getting into some of the issues, but maybe we should just from the outset talk a little bit, because I'm sure we have a sophisticated listenership and many of them will come up against some of this well-known critique that, say, the municipal socialists were overly cautious, technocratic, even quasi-progressive, too focused on clean government and infrastructure, not enough on transformative politics. And even, I was thinking more about this stuff when I read your article, questioned my own assumptions and maybe even prejudices. I once interviewed John Nichols when he wrote, a chapter or two in a book, I think it's at least a decade old, about the sewer socialists. He lives in Madison. You know, part of the critique that those of us on the far left is that it's too easy to adapt to the rhythm of electoral politics, to be co-opted by the Democratic Party, that it inevitably makes the sewers more important than the socialism, and soon the socialists turn into technocrats. And this certainly happened to the European social democrats in the 30s and 40s. And so, you know, it's sort of like you know, what do we expect from socialists? And I think in your article, you really go into this a lot. And I should just also say for listeners who really know, the same critique came up in 1934 in Minneapolis after the Teamster strike. And then they were saying, well, wait a minute, we won a lot here. Can we have socialism in a single city? Hardly. So those are some of the broader critiques. Why don't you take some of them on early so we can get to the actual mechanics of governing?
Sure. And this goes back to your question about, you know, the term sewer socialist. It was a pejorative to dismiss the project in Milwaukee and Wisconsin as essentially doing no more than trying to improve local public services like the sewer. The thrust of my article is really to push back against that and to say, well, yeah, it's good they fixed the sewers because there was a lot of typhoid. And so, you know, if you're a worker in 1910, yeah, it's a pretty big deal if your kids are dying because there's open sewage. And so there is a level of maybe condescension or looking at things retroactively. At the time, these were really urgent material matters for working class people. But it doesn't address the bigger question, which is, did they really stay socialist? This is essentially what the question is. Were they really still seeking to overturn capitalism? And then how do you relate this local governance project to this bigger question of overthrowing capitalism? And to be honest, I didn't really know what to expect when I went into the research. What I found is it turns out that not only were they socialists, they remained socialists, and they articulated a pretty compelling vision of how these local struggles connected to the long-term goal. And their argument, and I think their experience demonstrated, was that if you can win real improvements in workers' lives, that is going to make a stronger case for the socialist project than just pure propaganda for Marxism. And they continue doing pure propaganda for Marxism and socialism. You have the mayor of Milwaukee in 1936, Time magazine does a cover on Daniel Hone. The title is Marxist Mayor, and the subtitle is He Gave Marx All the Credit. Well, there's a lot to that. You know, including the mayor who'd been mayor for over 24 years. He spends all of his time outside of government, like trying to agitate workers. He's speaking in front of, you know, massive crowds of strikers. He spends inordinate amount of time in meetings nationally trying to save the Socialist Party. Like, this was a committed cadre whose goal was, how do we get rid of capitalism? And what they saw, though, was that the biggest obstacle for moving in the direction of eliminating capitalism is workers' sense of resignation, the sense that nothing can be changed. And they understood that winning improvements in people's lives, not just from the top, but through a combination of political organizing with labor movement organizing, and that's a crucial piece. The sewer socialist wasn't just an electoral project. If anything, it was primarily a labor project. They started in the union movement. Before they had any electoral success, they spent all of their time trying to transform the existing unions. And through that union base, they were able to eventually, and it took decades, win local power and then a lot of statewide power as well. And their understanding was that if through struggle in the state and outside the state, we can make workers' lives better and workers can feel that they can change the world, it's precisely through that process that we can recruit large numbers of workers to the socialist movement and we can win them to a long-term socialist goal. And they did that. They recruited more people to socialism and Marxism than anywhere else in the country. So I think the proof is a little bit in the pudding that they didn't just limit themselves to a purely technocratic effort. They built a mass socialist movement, and they really did stick to this goal of getting rid of capitalism. And the fact that they didn't get rid of capitalism is not so surprising because they only had power in Milwaukee and part of Wisconsin. So you can't overthrow capitalism just with that limited amount of power. But they pushed as far as they could go within the context they operated.
And maybe you should, for our listeners, talk a little bit about the political parties. You mentioned the Socialist Party, and then there's the SLP, the Socialist Labor Party, and you have these different figures. But one of the things that we're talking about was a guy named Victor Berger. And I was struck by the quote that you had, and it goes to what you were just saying, Eric, and that is that the most formidable obstacle in the way of further progress, and especially in the propaganda of socialism, is not that men are insufficiently versed in political economy or lacking in intelligence. It's that people are without hope. Despair is the chief opponent of progress. Our greatest need is hope. And that seems like that's very much the kind of politics that we saw today in the electoral process in New York that carried Mamdani to victory. It wasn't just hope, but also concentrating the message on people's actual needs now, which is affordability. Maybe you could just give our listeners a sort of overview of the arguments at the time when Berger was arguing against, say, Daniel de Leon and others.
I'm really glad you gave that quote, in part because I think it is it's really an important idea. But then also, it is interesting, if you listen to Zoran's victory speech, he makes almost the identical point. And I don't think that's because he read my article, because the article wasn't out yet. But I think it's because they understand something fundamental about the obstacles and the opportunities for working class organizing. And that really set Berger and someone like Zoran apart from their critics to the further left. And the debate really was not over goals. They were all socialists. You know, they weren't trying to just build a welfare state. Obviously, they wanted more public services. They wanted better things. But their goal was to socialize the economy, to have a democratic economy, a democratic state. The question was the means. How do you do that? The essential strategy of someone like Daniel De Leon, and this was the first party, the Socialist Labor Party. And so if anything, they had the best shot. They've been around for almost two decades before. But their approach was essentially to make the case for socialism and some labor organizing as well. But they had a theory that really, if you can get the word out, eventually workers will come around and understand that we need socialism because it makes sense, because our ideas are correct. We can explain the world. And so we should run in elections to sort of make the case for socialism. We should organize unions, make the case for socialism in these unions, and eventually workers will come around. This was the fundamental idea. And there's something to having a long-term perspective. There's also something to the necessity for making a case for socialism. It's hard to get to socialism if you don't make a case for it. But the criticism that Berger had, and that I think he showed there was an alternative, as you suggest, there's only so far you're going to go with just propaganda, you know, just getting the good word out. You need to win a base. And in fact, the only way you can build a real base is if you can show working people you're capable of improving their lives. And if you're not capable of showing that and not just saying down the road, we'll, you know, have a socialist commonwealth and, you know, brilliant future, if you can't actually improve people's lives in the here and now, they're not going to sign up en masse. You might get a few here and there, but you're not going to be able to organize a majority of the working class. And so if your goal is actually to organize a majority of the working class for socialism, you need to have a mechanism to do that. And the mechanism isn't solely propaganda. The mechanism is building union fights to make improve workers' lives. It's to show that the state can do what private enterprise says it is only able to do. And so part of their argument is, if we can build up public services and if we can municipalize some of these services, we can show that the state is actually a better and more efficient way of running production than private capital. So it wasn't just that improving workers' lives, but they wanted to have a proof of concept that an alternative way of organizing production was possible.
I think this is really important because as you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, the traditional critique, which I think has its merits, as you've just said, but it's also based in isolation. Of course, most of us come from a period after, you know, Stalinism took control in the Soviet Union and destroyed a lot of the basic tenets of socialism, which is workers' control from below and a genuinely democratic society in which the workers not only make the plan, but they implement the plan and they don't have rulers from up above. And so it destroyed all of that and left most of the socialists in the advanced capitalist world isolated and from the outside, just trying to win people over to their point of view. Whereas here, and this is before even the Russian Revolution that we're talking about, these were socialists that were able to contest power and win the mayoralty and to win city council. We're again in a period where we're starting to see some of that, but I'm just trying to be just slightly sympathetic to the critique while understanding what it means, because I think most of the older critique kind of misses this strategic logic of the approach that Berger and others were putting forward that you explained very well in your article, Eric. So before we get into the sort of limits of the approach, I want to get into the practical achievements. That's their multilingual organizing, union alliances. And maybe you could just walk us through what they did achieve in power and how they did it.
It's worth starting even before they came in power. And that's one of the things I just learned. I didn't know the history. I had been told or had the impression of, well, there was a lot of Germans in Milwaukee. They all supported socialism and they elected a socialist. Well, there's a kernel of truth. But on a national level, actually, Germans voted less for socialism. It's not like they were all inclined. Because you think about it, the people who migrated to the U.S. were like, you know, they believed in the American dream. And so it wasn't actually the case that there was just this full disposition towards socialism amongst Germans. It took them about 30 years to start winning elections. So, you know, Berger arrives in the 1870s. They don't win their first serious election, even on a local level, until 1904. most of the late 1890s, they're basically just doing union work. They're trying to just like win over workers to the ideas of socialism, but also just become good unionists. They were transforming the existing unions rather than building dual unions. And through this slow and steady work of education, but just organizing, building roots in the working class, particularly amongst Germans at first, they started building this base. They built a strong union base, and then they started winning local city elections. And this is an interesting parallel with New York City and Chicago and some of the other places where you're saying, well, you don't, you can't just win a mayoral race first. You have to build a political machine. And they spent a lot of time learning how to do that. And they invented the new techniques. Like, how do you get 50,000 newspapers out in 2 hours on a Sunday morning? And they had this mass volunteer operation, which really reminded me in many ways of New York City DSA, which has these mass canvassing operations in which the way we elected Zoran, because we were out knocking doors. And they had a very similar approach where they built this political machine with a high degree of involvement. They won some local races in 1904. And then the big breakthrough at first was in 1910. They won the mayor race. Then basically up through 1940, with a few off and on where they were out of power, they really ran the city up through 1940. And then there was a later iteration from 1948 through 1960 as well. So this is a large period of time in which you had a socialist mayor and a large socialist movement. What they did in power, they did a lot. So we can dig into the specifics, but it's just worth flagging some of the highlights. They municipalized a significant number of public services, things that maybe we take for granted now, but they were able to show the city was able to do this. They were really a pioneer for a lot of the policies that came to be the norm under the progressive era, and then that also came to be the norm of the New Deal. I look at really the sewer socialists as really like the vanguard of the best of the New Deal, if you want to think about it this way. They put into practice, and then they made the case both in the state and nationally, because it's worth considering that they won in Milwaukee, but they also won the first socialist to Congress ever in 1910. Victor Berger gets elected in 1910 to Congress, and he's basically like the equivalent of the AOC of the era. You know, he was like, oh, wow, you elected, although he's probably a little to the left of AOC. It was in the sense of that people were really excited, like a socialist in Congress, oh my goodness. And so he was agitating on a national level for a lot of the policies that ended up sort of only getting implemented during the New Deal. But on a local level, they went quite far. They massively built up public services. They played a huge role in building up the union movement. Because again, keep in mind, they came out of the union movement and they didn't think you could just pass all of this stuff from the top down. And this was a really big difference that they had from liberals and progressive mayors who had kind of like a benevolent approach towards workers. They saw this as a mass movement approach. And maybe we can talk about that more later. But on the specifics of union density, they were able to get Milwaukee to have by far the highest union density anywhere in the country. By the late 30s, 60% of workers in Milwaukee were members of unions, and there was nowhere even close. New York City, which, to give you a counterexample, which also had a big socialist labor movement, only got to 33%. So there's just this is unprecedented, unparalleled level of working class strength. And then in the government, it wasn't just public services. They really made the city a place that was accessible and beautiful for workers. This was part of what they did. Part of it was dealing with health and safety issues at work. They had a lot of focus on like making workplaces less dangerous. So they had like factory inspectors, but then they also, you know, made neighborhoods less dangerous through sewers and stuff like that. It was the roses piece. It wasn't just the bread piece. It was the roses, meaning they built a lot of parks, and that could seem, okay, well, you know, that's like minor stuff, but actually it's a pretty big deal, because when you're building public space, which was not the norm in this period, it's saying something to ordinary working class people that you have the right to live a dignified life. You have the right to enjoyment too. And that was very much the spirit that they governed in, which is how do we make a city in which working class people can have a good life? You know, it wasn't just the parks. They had like free opera for workers. They had all of these like really robust social centers locally. This was a big part of what they did. They had like the most robust parks and rec department anywhere in the country. And again, you can say that's limited, but it was a huge deal because it created like a very robust educational, cultural, thriving working class life. I would just say, as far as their achievements, is the last piece, they succeeded in doing what none of the other administrations did, which was end corruption. So part of the reason that they were so successful is that because they were anti-capitalist, they refused to take bribes from, you know, big companies. And that was the source of corruption. And this is why they were very effective. And part of the reason they got elected is to say, look, all these politicians, they keep on saying they're going to run and stop corruption. Because no, every single person would say corruption is bad. This is like the big scandal. And then they would become just as corrupt as the other people. And so the argument of socialists, which turned out to be true, is as long as you keep on electing individuals who are essentially trying to make deals with big business, yeah, of course they're going to get corrupted. That's what greases the wheel of local governments. You need people who are committed to fighting the employers and, you know, leaning on workers if you're going to stop corruption. They did that well. And in the process, they showed that a different type of governance was possible. You know, we can talk more about how they pointed the way on a state and national level and through their movements. But it was pretty impressive what they did. And by the 30s, everyone, even the critics, said that Milwaukee was the best governed city in the country. You know, so it was proof of concept that you can run a city as socialists. And the dangers that everyone warned about, it was the same thing that happened with Zoran. You know, they were predicting the apocalypse. Capital was going to flee. There's going to be anarchy everywhere. None of that happened. The exact opposite happened.
Right. And you're hearing a lot about that now, that there'll be a capital strike and, of course, a capital flight. So, but to go back to this, because what strikes me about this is, one, that the socialists elected to government delivered, and they delivered not just on, as you said, public, you know, works, but also competent, corruption-free politics, which was just a breath of fresh air and unexpected. And I'm really glad you also said that a lot of that came from making deals with business. So the first thing I thought when, you know, the difficulties when, and we've had socialist mayors in the United States, but it's very hard to come up against the employer backlash or, let's say, other structural barriers that we see. And one of the things that struck me in the way that you began your article, Eric, was to talk about the working class base and the unionism that existed at the time, even prior to like the 1930s, the height of working class militancy and the passage of the Wagner Act, which they kind of prefigure in Milwaukee. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what gave rise to that in Milwaukee, let's say, versus other places. Let's hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the gauge that socialists of the time in Milwaukee and Wisconsin used to see if they were successful wasn't primarily how many elections they won. It was how strong a workers' movement they were building. Like, that's how they saw if they were making progress, how many members were joining the Socialist Party, how many workers were joining unions. And for them, everything, including the governmental piece, was a mechanism to build the strength of working class people. And that was their North Star. And so it's not surprising then that they spent a huge amount of effort, both through their electeds in office, but then also just through organizing in neighborhoods and in workplaces to build up a really robust working class culture and organization. So it's really fun reading about them because it's like almost this alternate universe where, you know, there's like socialist Sunday schools, there's all of these choirs, you know, there's a lot of singing. One of the things that they started doing is they would have these massive picnics in the summertime where you get, you know, tens of thousands of workers bring all of the family, and then they play games and there's music and Debs comes to speak nationwide. They had this like really robust, more than anywhere else really in the country, sense of a working class movement as being an all-encompassing part of your life. There were sports leagues. There was just any part of life of ordinary workers that which normally can be isolating, or you have to, you know, you pit it against other people, or you just don't have access to these sort of collective effervescences. They provided that.
Say a word about the singing. I thought I was really struck by that in your article, that some party branches were so proud of their singers that when they organized, the first question they asked is, can you sing?
Yeah, you know, and so there was like friendly competition on, you know, which were the branches that sang the best. There was an anecdote that I don't even think I included in the article where they would have these parades. And the way it was described is that every single worker who had a horn would come and they would use their horn in the parade. And some of them were really good. Some of them were not as good, but everyone had their horn in the parade, you know, so that was the spirit of it. And it was because of that, that they were able to really elect so many people because they had a deep, deep, deep base in the working class, you know, so it's not just the cultural stuff, but they led these unions. So this was a union movement as well, in which they're fighting the boss, they're trying to organize workers, they're organizing not just the German workers, but they're starting to organize the Polish workers, which was the main sort of other ethnic group in the time. And these were hard struggles too. It's not like it was, you know, class peace in Milwaukee. There's constant strikes, there's constant fights. So much so that one of the things that they did in office, and this is really gets to how they got union density so high, is they constantly tried to use and were pretty successful in using city government to stop breaking strikes. This was a crucial thing because think about the context before is that the norm in this era was just, you know, state repression over and over and over again, smashing workers trying to strike to build unions. Socialist mayors put an end to that what they did is they even threatened at one point to deputize workers when there was a really big strike. And if the police didn't obey, they were going to deputize workers to uphold law and order. And they were able to essentially force the issue, and they were able to neutralize the police as a repressive force in a really remarkable way. And, you know, they didn't defund the police. They didn't say we're going to abolish the police. They actually sort of created a wedge where they improved the working conditions of some of the police, but they simultaneously made laws and made policies so that they couldn't attack workers. And they had a big fight to sort of wedge the rank and file police against the reactionary police chief. So smart, you know, and it's maybe there's some resonance in what Zoran is going to have to do, that you're not going to be able to take on all of the police even if you wanted to. What you actually have to do is try to neutralize that force as much as possible.
I want to ask you a lot of questions about, you know, the parallels for today, as you started to intimate. But there's also the way you were just describing the atmosphere in Milwaukee was one of community and, I guess, association, and not the kind of atomization and hopelessness in a way that you see today, where a lot of the organizations have been smashed, that their social media atomizes people even more. And even though Zoran, you know, was a master of social media and using it to organize people, it just seems like in some ways it sounds like it was easier to do this than, I don't know if you think that or if there's any real parallel there, but was it because it was sort of pristine and new to organize in this way?
I do think it was easier in some ways to organize in the era. I don't think it's because it was new. I think it was because the political economy and sort of social geography of working class life was very different. Even before sort of the rise of socialism and all of this, there was more of a sort of basic building block of working class life. So workers, for instance, even before the socialist movement, would know each other because they live next to each other, right? This is, imagine a world in which most of your neighbors maybe work in the same plant or next to you, in which you might go to the same church, in which, and this was big in Milwaukee, as you can imagine, if you know anything about German workers, there was a lot of taverns. There was a huge, really robust tavern life in which workers, and, you know, mostly men, then there was a gendered aspect to that, particularly the taverns. But, you know, they would talk after work, and they knew each other, and there was no internet. There was no, you couldn't go home and watch a movie. If you wanted to have fun, you had to like go out and socialize with people, and you were close to them. And life was compact enough that you really knew so much of your community. So I actually think some of the community dynamics predate socialism. They were able to build off of that and give it a political content, and they were able to make it much more robust. But it is, I think it's the big challenge that we face today, is we are in a far more atomized context. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it impossible, but we're actually starting from a much lower level of just basic working class cohesion than existed in the 1920s.
Last week, I interviewed three of the organizers from South Asian communities and others, Cav Voice, and I sort of asked them that question, how they were organizing. This is for Mamdani's victory, because mostly, and as you just said, it's difficult to organize outside the workplace, but in the communities. And this is something that was done very successfully in New York. And so it seems that's the kind of miracle, I guess, of Mamdani's victory, that you could go back to that other form of organizing, and that they were able to mobilize, as you said, along with New York's branch of DSA, some 100,000 volunteers who didn't just read a script when they knocked on doors, but actually engaged in conversation, which is the way to draw people in. But then there were also all of these immigrant associations, workers' associations outside of formal workplace organizing, which, you know, as we know today, it's much more difficult to have unions in a lot of these workplaces. So maybe, I guess we shouldn't jump too far ahead, but it's something I wanted you to just comment on.
Yeah, I think maybe New York is one of the exceptions in the United States still, as far as the compactness of like working class life and urban life, just because of the nature of the city. It hasn't been able to spread out like a, you know, Southern California or Los Angeles. People don't drive as much. So there's just more of a street life. There's more of a neighborhood life that you're able to build off. And there's frankly still more of an immigrant life. And so, you know, a big part of the story, and this is maybe a similarity, is these were immigrant socialists. A lot of them became Americanized in Milwaukee. And again, the real huge shifts we saw in immigrant workers and workers of color in New York, it reflects to a certain extent that fortunately life hasn't become as atomized here as maybe in some other places. And we have all of the same issues, but I think there's reason to hope that it hasn't gone so far towards atomization that it's impossible to turn things around.
Well, let's move a little bit into some of what actually happened in Milwaukee. And because, as you mentioned, they were in power for 50 years. In 1940, it was finally dead, which is kind of ironic in a way, because that's still at the height of the new militancy of workers in the United States. And now with the brand new New Deal, somehow it comes to an end. So you argue that the movement's decline wasn't due to their model being flawed, but to broader shifts in class power and national politics. So maybe for our listeners, Eric Blanc, you could go over some of those key turning points and even ask the question, at that point later on, was there something Milwaukee socialists could have done differently, or were they just running up against the fundamental limits of this municipal level socialism?
It's a great question. One of the things that I found and I was surprised by was the extent to which the sewer socialists stayed both strong and very radical through the 1930s. And so when you look at the fights in the 1930s, they do all sorts of stuff that you're like, wow, you can understand why this was not just like a technocratic governance. One of the things they did in 1935, just to give you a sense of why they ended up, this leads to the question of why they ended up losing, because there was a huge backlash against them. 1935, they passed the most radical labor law that's ever happened in the United States. It's called the Bonsell Ordinance, in which any factory in which the employers were refusing to bargain with unions, and then it led to a protest of 200 or more people for 2 days in a row, the city would close the factory. It gave themselves the right to close that factory. And if the employers refused, they could either be fined or jailed. So this gives you a sense of how committed they were to class struggle and class power. And part of the story of the 1930s is different than the way we normally think about it. And what ended up happening is actually there was a huge amount of backlash to the militancy of the 1930s. And this is a piece of the story that really oftentimes gets minimized, but really by the late 1930s, starting in 1938 in particular, there's a backlash against the most progressive and militant parts of the New Deal everywhere. There was, you know, sit-down strikes were great for winning unions, but amongst both middle-class people and some of the workers that were not as organized, there was really a sense of like, oh, the country's becoming anarchic, we've gone too far. And it became harder for the socialists to win in the same way that all across the country in 1938, all of the leftists who are in power, including in Minnesota and Michigan, they get voted out because there's a backlash, even by against the New Deal, which wasn't so militant, you know, and it was a backlash against Roosevelt. It was in that context, essentially, they just got voted out. It wasn't that they had gotten absorbed into the system, but that the reality is, and this is a sobering dynamic, is that United States political culture and public opinion was never as radical as we would wish it to be. Even in the 1930s, there was a degree to which the socialists were running against the tide. And despite all of these years of education and the big important movement, they've never even had a majority in the city council for most of these years. It gives you a sense of how hard it was. And it wasn't for lack of trying, but it was just to actually consistently win a majority of a city, especially when the capitalists are constantly saying you're destroying, you know, there's constant barrage. It's just very difficult. And it's a question of power and organization more than anything else. And at a certain point, there was enough backlash that they lost the election. And, you know, that was the story really across the board of the New Deal, is that there was backlash against it continuing to go forward. And then the Democratic Party sort of retreats and labor retreats with it. In Milwaukee, though, they didn't really retreat. They lost. And sometimes you lose. They made huge gains across the way. It was not like it was up for naught. They changed the world. It is sobering to think that sometimes the biggest obstacle is just an absence of power.
Right. And I was thinking as you were speaking, Eric, that there's also the question nationwide, as they were moving into the New Deal, it was early on to be able to actually enjoy the fruits of the New Deal, whereas in Milwaukee, it had been in power for a long time. So your explanation that they were sort of, you know, going along with the tide and public opinion and coming up against, of course, even I don't know, this sort of form of Americanism that stresses, you know, rugged individualism and progress. I don't know how much that had to do with it. But there's also the question of race. And I wondered, it's always an immigrant society. You're talking about Milwaukee in this period, and you talked about the German immigrants. But what about, you know, was race used to divide the working class in this period?
Yeah, this is another interesting thing I found, which was that there's a perception, which is not entirely wrong, that Victor Berger, the founder of sewer socialism, was like intransigent racist. And it's true that in his early writings, there's some instances in which he said horribly racist things. Bizarrely, it was in articles trying to explain why Black people were oppressed. So it was very confused, but there was racist language and basically indefensible. It's worth keeping in mind that this is a period in which there were almost no people of color in Wisconsin. And so the big shift happens after World War I, in which there's a mass influx of Black workers. And this was, I was just very surprised to hear about that. Victor Berger and the Sewer Socialists become adamant fighters against racism, and they fight the KKK. And Victor Berger, in fact, becomes the most prominent spokesperson in Congress to try to ban lynching and the KKK. And they win overwhelming support amongst Black workers. The Black workers were actually primarily represented by Victor Berger, like the 6th Ward of Milwaukee. That was Victor Berger's congressional seat. And he won their support overwhelmingly. Mayor Hone won their support. He joined the NAACP in 1920. And so much so that the Black nationalists, the Garveyites of the era, the leaders in Milwaukee ended up joining the Socialist Party and actually advocated their candidates against like Black middle class candidates. So it gives you a sense of really like when you have a anti-racist socialist perspective, you are able to overcome a lot of the divisions that you might have expected in the era.
Great. So let's move now in the last part of the show to the present, the lessons for today, because that's why you undertook this research in the first place. I've already asked you some of the questions about what are the most important lessons that Milwaukee offers for the left. But as you already said, that one of your central claims is that socialists govern competently, but they also organize deeply. So how do you see Mamdani and the New York City left balancing those two dual imperatives?
The first thing I would say is that it's really remarkable the extent to which there is an overlap in strategy and focus of Zoran and the Sewer Socialists. And so one of the things that was just absolutely central to the Sewer Socialists, which Zoran has done, is focus on people's immediate material needs. And so it's just, if you look at the literature on the Sewer Socialists, like if you look at what they were agitating around, what were the leaflets, what were the speeches they were making, overwhelming cost of living over and over and over again. And that's not surprising. The other point that I would stress is that they understood that you had to make public service deliver. And it wasn't enough just to promise things. You had to deliver to working class people and you had to fulfill your mandate. And Zoran is obsessed, correctly so, with saying that he won a mandate and fighting to make it happen. And part of that is changing the way city government works so that it's actually able to deliver. And it's interesting, there's again a parallel with the Sewer Socialists. They were the first administration anywhere in the country to bring in like experts on how to make city government more efficient, because they understood that in order to make the case that the public sector can do these things well, you actually had to learn how to do it well. And so I think this is, again, the spirit of what Zoran is doing, is like, how do we make city government actually work for working class people? And then the difference I would see really between that era, the 20s, and today is that they had had, in Milwaukee, decades of increasing working class organization and strength before they won the mayorship. And if anything, today we're at the exact opposite end of the spectrum in which Zoran has been able to win despite a decline in labor organizing and strength for many years. Not just unions, but you know, the socialist movement today, even in New York for all of our strength, is still much weaker and much less rooted than it was then. And to me, this is the big challenge. And I do think that this is going to be the hardest thing to do, is how do we move in the direction of building that kind of deep organized working class base that we don't yet have. We have movement in that direction. You know, it's a big deal. You can get 100,000 volunteers, over 100,000 people volunteered for Zoran. So that gives you, you know, a sense of the scale that we're operating at. But most of those people are not members of Democratic Socialists yet. They're not members of unions, and they're not necessarily even still committed to continuing to fight, you know, because electing people is one thing. And now we have to explain, well, actually the real organizing or the hardest organizing begins now. And there's certainly a commitment to winning and fighting still. And I'm excited, you know, to be involved in efforts to build a mass movement to win Zoran's agenda, in addition to New York City DSA, which is obviously playing a central role in that and has launched a Tax the Rich campaign. There's a new initiative that comes out of the sort of movement that elected Zoran to transition these 100,000 volunteers to organize communities to win his agenda. It's called Our Time, and it's to win the three planks that Zoran was elected on.
It's really exciting. It's a beacon of hope as well. And one of the things I read somewhere, you know, you just stressed that Zoran was successful because he stuck to affordability as one thing. And this was also something that the sewer socialists did. They stuck to the cost of living, as you said, or how do you pay your bills, rather than ideological appeals. We've already gone over some of that. But I found that Mamdani was directly asked about the sewer socialists. And he said, it comes back to exactly what you're saying, which is reclaiming the language of quality of life as a left-wing concern, because it is often described as if it is somehow conservative. You know, something that it wasn't alien to Zoran's form of organizing. And I shouldn't just talk about Zoran, because it wasn't just Zoran. It was this army around him and this base that he had. But I think one of the challenges that is ahead is, you know, how New York socialists around and New York organizers around Zoran are going to be able to build political infrastructure independent of the Democratic Party. This is that old question of being co-opted, and the Milwaukee socialists were able to do that. But how do you see that, you know, in 21st century America, and especially in New York?
Yeah, it's one of the differences. Obviously, the Socialist Party were a third party, whereas our socialist movement today is operating essentially as an independent faction within the Democratic Party. And that has to do with both the entrenchment of the party system over the last century.
Right.
So the rise of primaries, for instance, there weren't some really primaries. There wasn't the space to work within the Democrats like there is today. And that makes it both easier in some ways, but also harder, because it's harder to work outside of the party system. And then also the polarization today is much stronger than it was in the 1920s. In the 1920s, it's like the progressives in Wisconsin were Republicans. Just to give you a sense of it, the allies of the socialists were Republicans. So it's just a totally different party system. What that means is to operate within the Democratic Party is really, really tough. I do think we have an independent infrastructure. It's not actually the case that somehow we're operating within the structures of the Democratic Party, which frankly barely even exist.
Exactly.
You know, like it's like, you know, it's mostly a ballot line plus a few like apparatchiks. And then what it is, though, there's an establishment.
Donors.
Yeah, and the donors, you know, on a state level. But, you know, in New York City, it's very porous. But you have this real obstacle of someone like a Kathy Hochul, who's the governor, who's, you know, getting funded like all Democrat establishment people are by the same companies and the same corporations that we're trying to tax right now to fund Zoran's agenda. The interesting thing is the extent to which this power we built from below has already forced someone like Hochul to endorse Zoran, right? That's not going to happen just out of the goodness of her heart. She sees the way the winds are blowing. But to get someone like Hochul, who's still refusing to say she'll tax the rich, to get her to commit to taxing the rich, that is the obstacle. And this pits us directly against the Democratic Party establishment. It means we also need an alliance with them to a certain extent against Trump. You know, this is why it's so tricky. There's the whole question of Trump, too. This is a big difference of the 20s and 30s, is you have an authoritarian trying to, you know, potentially destroy you. Although we'll see, maybe Zoran can talk some sense into him on Friday, you know. But it is a different context. I would say that the challenge is you both need to organize independently of the Democratic establishment, but also, you know, find ways to work with them against the right, and also to put pressure on them to do the right thing in relation to the policies we need. And it's a really, really, really difficult balancing act. I don't think there's any easy solution to that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, they did not have a Trump, you know, and Trump is a New Yorker, and he's already signaled that he wants to send the military into these Democratic cities, and he's been doing it, not to any success. And I think this is a very different discussion, but I think Trump is on the downslope now, not the up. So, but nonetheless, he can wreak a lot of havoc and damage. And so, what do you think are the biggest pitfalls that Mamdani's going to face, or the Mamdani incoming administration, and which ones can they avoid, especially that, I guess, expose the limitations of the Milwaukee socialists?
So, there's a million obstacles. There's a reason people say that being New York City mayor is the second hardest job in the United States after being president. And if we're being honest, there's huge dangers because the expectations are so high. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, the sort of future of our project rests on our ability to deliver. I would say that the biggest obstacle I would see right now, in addition to the obvious ones, which are that the employers are going to try to demonize you, the employers are going to try to use the media against you, right? All of the classic fear-mongering is going to continue. And you can be sure that the second there's any weakness or any crisis anything bad happens in the city, somebody gets shot. Some, you know, like all of the things that happen in the city are going to get, there's going to be a immediate blame against Zoran, even if this is something that normally happens in any city life. In addition to all of that, which is just the background condition for why it's hard, I would say that the tricky thing for Zoran and our movement is going to be, how do you combine working within the government, you know, working essentially within the system in this huge bureaucracy, with combining an outside pressure game? And this is a really, really difficult thing. And it goes to what we were talking about before, because Zoran simultaneously has to like have working relationships with a lot of establishment politicians just for the basic functioning of the city in relation to the state. And just to concretize it, he has to work with the governor just for a million different reasons, not least of which is Trump, but just for the functioning of the city. But it's also the case that our ability to deliver on his agenda is going to be in part dependent on whether Hochul, the governor, is so scared of the movement that she's worried she'll get primaried out, right? Because there's a left primary challenger to her. And it, we, part of the reason I think we can win and we need in our movement is if we can show that New Yorkers are overwhelmingly want to tax the rich to fund an affordability agenda, well, then Hochul is going to be, you know, worried about what happens if she says no to that. But Zoran is stuck between these two things because he both needs to work with the governor, but be linked to a movement that is potentially primarying her and potentially challenging her and actively right now organizing to call on her to do something she doesn't want to do. And the worry I would have is that, and I don't think this will be the case immediately, but there's going to be a lot of pressure on Zoran to distance himself from the movement. This is what always happens. And this is the genuine concern I think that socialists have always had. And it's a reality. It's not a wrong concern. Is, you know, when you're organizing outside of the state, that comes oftentimes up against your allies in government. And I think there's going to be moments of tension and there's going to be inevitable moments and we're going to have to navigate this tricky situation of how do we push the state, including Zoran, at moments. And I don't think it's going to be just through like denouncing him online or nitpicking at every single thing he does. I think it's going to be primarily about building enough power in workplaces and in neighborhoods that establishment cedes to us. But, you know, that's a big if. We need to make it actually happen now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, one of the big challenges will be to keep this coalition together that rode him to power now that he's going to be in power. And you've just stated some of the huge, you know, backlash measures that you may well see. But I find it very interesting what you just said about Governor Hochul and how frightened she is. You haven't seen that. You know, you still didn't get either the endorsement of either Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries. Oh my God, I just forgot. Who's the other person that did not endorse?
Gillibrand and Schumer.
And maybe they'll be primaried as well. But I guess that this really takes up the question of how broad the coalition is and how far you think it can go. And I've already asked you this, but let's hear it just one more time. What you think would be the most important strategic priorities that Mamdani should take up immediately that will help build, you know, the coalition and deliver some of his promises?
I think that the focus is clear, and Zoran has already made it clear, which is the focus is fulfilling the mandate that he won on. And he, unlike many other politicians, was very clear on what his mandate is. It's to pass free childcare for all, but it's to tax the rich in order to pay for that. It's fast and free buses, and it's to freeze the rent. The first thing we'll see is a push to freeze the rent because that's something that is most immediately doable by city government. And he's going to have a relentless focus on trying to pass that agenda. And, you know, it's going to be difficult because you can't do all of that just within the city. You need to have some level of state support for that, both for funding mechanisms and also preemption laws. So it's not something that's just entirely within his control. And that goes back to the question of power. And I think that I'm optimistic that Zoran is going to be able to navigate that because unlike so many other progressive politicians and even left politicians, he really does come out of the movement. And I think this is a similarity to the super socialists, is that he's genuinely a socialist. He comes out of movements and he has organic links and also just frankly has politics, you know, just his politics and a way of understanding the world and his class analysis will help him navigate this better than I think any sort of solo operator would do. And the fact that he can lean on and is connected to something like DSA makes a big difference because it's a collective project. It's not just an individual project.
Well, I have two final questions, Eric. This has been absolutely terrific, this conversation, but I was going to ask you what surprised you the most in this research, something that shifted your understanding of municipal socialists. And the final part of that would be, what does it tell us about the possibilities and limits of socialist governance or democratic socialist governance? We've had, you know, Bernie Sanders, we've had others around, but this is qualitatively different, I think, because it's so much larger and in the most important city. And so, you know, in answering the question of what was surprising and shifted your understanding, the final thing would be, are we at a moment that might even be more favorable than the Milwaukee era for, or is it more challenging?
I think in some ways we are in a more favorable moment because the political establishment is so discredited. And so this is something that's different than the 20s and 30s, yeah, in which, you know, the Democratic Party ended up coming under Roosevelt and you know, was quite popular. And that put a lot of constraints in many ways on how far the sort of left flank could go. Today, you know, think about it. Who are the real leaders of the Democratic base? Like, who are the base of Democrats looking to? They're looking to Bernie and AOC. You know, they're going out, right, and by the, you know, the largest numbers. And you see really like normal Democrats or even people who voted for Trump in New York City are voting for Zoran. So because of the crisis, it's part of the reason that you see the rise of Trumpism, but just the political center is so much more discredited. And so I do think that the possibilities for something beyond what we saw in the 30s are there. But the difficulty, again, is that the level of class organization we have is lower. So in some ways, the political openings are much higher, but the bottom-up dynamic is harder. It's not impossible. And I do think, you know, my optimistic take on how this could go is, especially as, you know, as you suggest, that Trumpism is weakening and Trump is getting weaker. I do think there's a world in which Zoran and the Democratic Socialist Movement and the sort of general anti-corporate fight is able to play a central role in defeating Trumpism. And then think what happens. All of these companies and all of these establishment politicians, including the Democrats, have so discredited themselves by bending the knee to Trump, right? That's why so many liberals and, you know, normal Democrats are angry at the Democrats, because they bent the knee. But same with the companies. All of these companies have bent the knee to Trump. What does that mean after you defeat Trumpism? I think there's a huge opening for saying, actually, only the workers' movement, only the left can actually rebuild and provide an alternative. And we're not sullied by having sucked up to, you know, a billionaire oligarchy. And I think that that is the promise, not in the 2 years, 3 years, but, you know, in the 5, 10 years, there is a potential for transforming this country. And I think that Zoran shows that we really need to raise our ambitions. You know, something that seemed impossible, I didn't think he was going to win. You know, something that seemed impossible becomes possible in this moment of crisis. And I think that that is maybe the biggest lesson, is to raise our ambitions, to be more hopeful, and to understand that actually many working class people are looking for an alternative. And if we provide that big, bold alternative, they will seize it.
From your mouth to all of our ears, Eric Block, I can't thank you enough for everything today and for this article. And let the listeners know that you can read it at Eric's Substack, which is called Labor Politics. The article is Socialists in City Hall, a new at Sewer Socialism in Wisconsin. And Eric is assistant professor at Rutgers University. His recent book is We Are the Union, and the one before that is Red State Revolt. We talked about both of them right here. And you can Google Eric and find all of the rest of his articles and even his record of organizing. Thanks so much for being with us today, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me, Susie.
Thanks. And that's our show for today. I want to thank my guest, Eric Blanc. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. There's also more information on programs and guests on our Facebook page, again, Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you get your podcast. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Hi, Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday